Andy, welcome to the Data Bytes podcast. How's your day been going so far?
Well, it's great to be here, Sadie. My day is going very well. Yeah, we've got some exciting news about books, which we can talk about in this podcast. Otherwise, it's a Friday as we record, so I'm just winding down after a very busy week.
Yes, but I believe you're located in the UK, so it's the end of the day for you. It's the beginning of my Friday, but either way, we both have Friday energy going on right now, whether it's the end of the day or beginning.
Yeah, so we're going to be loose and fast on this podcast. It's going to be, I'm going to go off the rails, I think, Sadie.
I love it. That's exactly what we want. So you have been at Tableau for a little over 12 years as a data evangelist. You're also the author of Big Book of Dashboard and the co-host of Chart Chat. So I'm so excited to chat with you today because the evolution of dashboards has gone under a major transformation in the past 5 years, 10 years. And I think it's probably going to go through one now with all of the new releases with what's happening in AI. So would love to just kind of get your take on it and how has the landscape of data visualization and what was even prior to that called business intelligence, right? If we're going way back, changed with the invent of Tableau and just dashboards over the years?
Yeah, wow. So dashboards. Okay, so what is a dashboard? I mean, Sadie, a dashboard, do you know what a dashboard originally was? It was a board of leather or wood on a stagecoach, which was between the driver and the horses, and that board stopped water dashing onto the driver's feet, right? So that was the dashboard. And then when they invented cars, so as not to freak people out, they kind of kept those things at the front of cars, the first cars, and then they put a gauge on it and they called it a dashboard. The reason I say that is because what I found over the last, or since we wrote our book, is people are like, well, what is a dashboard? We can't even agree on this term. Stephen Few wrote a book about dashboards 20 years ago, you know, had a massive influence on my career as a data analyst in 2007. But he had a very, very dogmatic, strict view of dashboards about information density, precision for rapid insight and overviews. Must be on a single screen and must be on a single screen. We wrote the Big Book of Dashboards in 2017 and we're like, well, hang on. Is that kind of right? Because by 2017, you got things like Tableau Public, on which people are building dashboards, but are they infographics? They look much more flowery in a positive way, much more focused on story, but Tableau would still call them dashboards. And then you got the advent of really rich interactivity, and as we all got smartphones, it's like, well, we could monitor data on these things too, but does that information dense single screen thing work on here? So when we were trying to define a dashboard, we really struggled. And in the end, we had a really vague definition of a dashboard. A view of data designed to facilitate or monitor, designed to facilitate understanding. I forget exactly what the exact definition was, but basically I forget because it was 15 words. It was really vague. Because it's like a dashboard means so many things. So then in 2017, we were like, the definition is not important. What is important is the goal. Are you condensing the message for the people, the audience you are designing for? And you have to have an audience in mind. It can't just be everybody in your organization. And in the right form factor, mobile, desktop, piece of paper, email, so that they can get the insights in the least time possible, right? So that's where we put our stake in the ground in the Big Book of Dashboards in 2017. Nick Debra has pushed the definition forward with a great taxonomy of dashboards. That book's coming out, Practical Dashboarding, that's coming out next year, or 2024. So what's going on with it is that, so to have set up that context, the evolution of the dashboards is, for me, I think, I'm happier that people are just thinking, what am I trying to achieve and what do my people need to see to get this goal, right? One trend I see is Stephen Few wanted precise information dense dashboards. These days, I see dashboards seem to have a lot less information on them than they used to. There seems to be less information. I get a sense people are leaning back to making... thinking more about design and look and feel than actual information precision. You know, there's a lot of Figma design dashboards. I don't see those as a problem, but I feel like we could go back towards information density that Stephen Few liked. Some people might say that's controversial as an opinion. So I've seen design kind of really take off in dashboards. I think I would like to see a focus again on information precision for monitoring dashboards. But, you know, as we can talk about, you know, in more detail, AI is potentially changing everything. You know, as we think for the next 5-10 years, I mean, right now, GPTs are, you know, everything we can do, we can interact with through a chatbot, right? And so do we need a dashboard? If I could just ask Gemini or ChatGPT or Claude, tell me the insights to the data. Personally, the work I've done this year, I think we're a long way from that. But it's going to transform things at some point in the next few years.
So you mentioned something subliminally, which is there seem to be these schools of thought with dashboards. And it also seems to be like you're in one camp or another and the two camps don't like each other. So I remember when I first started as a research analyst and then an analytics engineer, I was in a large company and we used, the team I was on used Cosmos and another team used Tableau. And I will say I was not a fan of Cosmos, I'll be honest. I wanted to be on the Tableau team, but I had to align with my leadership, right? And there was always kind of this feud going on of why one was better and another was better. And then there's also this school of thought too, which is like, we should have a lot of information on a dashboard or we shouldn't have a lot of information. And you mentioned another one, which is now there's a new trend of design is really important and getting away so much from the amount of information, but look and feel. Is it about dashboards that make people so emotionally attached, I would say? And also, you know, get this idea of a right way versus a wrong way. How do we get into that vein of things? And why do you think that happens?
I think as technology savvy people, people want certainty in what they're doing. And people have a very strong sense of ownership if they are creating something, right? If I create a piece of work for you, for a team, for an organization, then, you know, I have a sense of ownership and defensive sense of ownership, right? You know, when I was working as a data analyst at the University of Oxford, I certainly had that. I was very defensive of the things I was building, and I thought they were amazing. I probably thought they were better than they actually were. So I think people find it very easy to get set in their ways. But when we, you know, when I train people about dashboards, I have a whole session where I show a whole bunch of examples from the book. And it's like, is this a dashboard? And it's the question on each one of them. And even over six years, I'm still getting novel ways that people will push back about why they think this thing is or isn't a dashboard. And then you're like, well, why don't you think it's a dashboard? And then the answers to those questions aren't really because they don't think it's a dashboard. What they're doing is that they're challenging their assumptions or their knowledge of how these things are used, right? So an information dense dashboard, if I printed out a massive A3 piece of paper for a CEO to have a huge strategic overview of that CEO's entire organization, then that's a non-static printed out dashboard with a gazillion charts, right? I think that's a really effective dashboard. Or if I'm a fast moving sales executive on the road and I just want to see which accounts are moving up or down this today, right, not this month, then I might design a really simple thing that I can see on my cell phone so I can look at it and then I'm done, right? They're both dashboards according to our definition, because the definition is, the term is kind of meaningless. The goal is what counts. And I think sometimes people fixate a little bit on the definition rather than the goal.
I think that's fair. And I also really like your point on how we as technologists really love black and white. We don't work very well in a gray area. And it makes sense too, right? If you're an analyst who's building dashboards, you're probably attracted to this career in this field because you love to get to concrete answers, right? You want to know what the truth is. And so this kind of in between, is this yes or no? It's not a space that a lot of us as technologists like to play in. But I also think it's a space that we need to get more comfortable with because the world is ever evolving and changing too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the epiphany I had in my career. So in 2010, or well, in 2007, when I started using, when I was working as an analyst, you know, I was a real disciple of Stephen Fee. And he was incredibly dogmatic about precision, accuracy, any kind of inaccurate decoding, bubble charts or flowery stuff. He's like, this is sacrilegious. This is not data visualization. And I was like, I'm with you, Steve. And then at the same time, along comes David McCandless and other people who are creating books like Information is Beautiful. And, you know, the Stephen Few perspective is like, well, this is garbage. But then you look at it and go, but I look at it, it's really nice to look at. And David McCandless is selling hundreds of thousands of books and getting TED Talks, and Stephen Few is not. So I'm like, well, you've got one guy here saying be precise and one guy here being successful. And that, you know, I mean, Stephen Few would argue with McCandless all the time. McCandless would just let it all wash over him. So my, you know, the epiphany I had was, well, they're both right, right? And we can lean one way or another, and we can take bits from one side of the argument, put them on the other side to achieve the goal we're trying to do for the purpose we're trying to aim for, right? And that is genuinely the thing that tension. Is the thing that has most excited me about my career, has most kept me in this career, because there's never going to be a right answer. It's always, how do I compromise to make the right articulation of data for any given project?
Yeah, so it reminds me of a quote that one of my piano teachers told me once, which is, you have to learn all the rules so that you can break all the rules. And I found that so odd, because I was like, well, what's the point in learning them? And I realized, like, it gives you this amazing foundation so you understand the structure and then you can play with the structure. So when you're telling me about, like, fell in love with Stephen Few and I also did it, that gave you your structure, right? It was almost just like, learn the rules of it. And we're in it, I think, for newly analysts, like, find somebody you really love, follow that structure, right? As you're learning to play music or art, we often copy whoever had created something before. And then once you have that structure, break the rules, right? And push the boundaries and see what works.
And absolutely right. And you know, and the boundaries, knowing how to, so two things. So one thing we see, I see on Reddit more than anywhere else, someone will post to the Tableau or Power BI or one of the data tool Reddits and go, I've seen this chart, I want to build it in Tableau or Power BI. And it's like, well, you've not really thought about why you do that. You know, you need to go back and get the foundation before you can push it. And, you know, you mentioned, you sort of talk about learning the rules and being inspired. So this book, Austin Kleon, Steal Like an Artist, is a book that really inspired us to write the big book of dashboards. And we use it to inspire others to go and find things, because what Austin Kleon was writing about in this book is it's absolutely legit to go and copy other people's work. Because when you copy someone else's work with honesty and legitimacy, you are putting you're putting your piano fingers or you're putting your pen on paper or your code in line to copy what they did. But in that process of doing it, you're adding your own synaptical little psychological addition to it. So we are completely in agreement there. You're dead right.
Yeah, big fan of the Still Like an Artist book. Highly recommend to anyone. I think it gives you that permission to, I don't even want to say it's copy other people's work, because I know when I would play a piece of music, even if it's something that I created from scratch, I will never play it the same time, exactly the same twice, right? And no one ever will. That's why we have covers of so many songs that also do well. It's like, yes, that is the exact same song and somebody else wrote, but we want to hear it in a different tone. And so I think it just is so nice to give us that permission.
Let me ask you a cover. I mean, cover. We love covers, right? But how many? The worst thing that I could think can ever happen with covers is when there's a song that's been a core part of your growth as either it's a teenager or as a song that's been part of your life, and then you discover that the version you know is actually a cover. And it's like, oh, right, you know, if you always thought it was an original, it turns out not to be. It's a bit disappointing.
Oh yeah, that's a that's a big letdown when you found out that you thought you had the original and you realize that, no, you don't even like the original, actually. That's even worse, right? When you find the original and you're like, I don't even like the original. I actually just like the cover.
I know. I was a teenager in the 1980s. Yeah, I'm not old. And I just discovered that Tainted Love by Soft Cell wasn't an original song by them. I'm like, oh my God, my whole worldview. Anyway, let's not talk about music.
Exactly. So you mentioned your book. I want to talk a little bit more about the Big Book of Dashboards. Your redo. Is this a version 2? Is it a new version of the book coming out? Tell me a little bit more about this book.
Well, yeah, so we're very excited. So the Big Book of Dashboards, amazingly, I don't have a copy to hand. That's like, never. That never happens. Anyway, so that came out in 2016, 2017. And it contained, you know, 28 real-world dashboards, real scenarios that we sort of put out there and broke down and explained how they worked. Again, with the intent that people would look at these and then steal ideas and use them in their own work. So that was really successful. What we've come to realize in the last couple of years is that, you know, we didn't really talk about process. We just went, here's a bunch of dashboards, off you go. And we found that, again, we had realized there wasn't a modern book about dashboards. So we'd identified that there was a niche to fill with the first book. And what we still don't think there is a dedicated book about dashboarding process. So yes, it's very exciting. We are about to embark on a second book, it's not a second edition. It is a new book about the process of building, of design, of conceiving, building, deploying and maintaining dashboards. Very excited. We are going to be seeking the best dashboards from all people across the world. So anybody watching or listening, hopefully you'll put links in notes, click a link. And if you've got a world-class dashboard you think we could feature in the Big Book of Dashboards, we would love to see it. And so that's going to take about a year to write. It's me, Steve and Jeff, but we've also got Amanda McCulloch, who's Exec Director at DataVision Society, joining us as author number 4. So, we're very excited.
That's incredible. I love that you're having a lot of examples. Again, you know, talking about finding others' work that you can emulate. I think that's so important. But now adding, like, what was that process to get there is really great. So, yeah, we'll be sure to include a link in the show notes for others to be able to share their dashboards. That's fantastic. I also want to go back to a comment you made, which is, you know, a lot of individuals are now starting to say GPTs or, you know, any kind of large language model is going to start to replace the dashboard, right? We're just going to talk to it. We're going to get our answer. And there's no need for us to have this, you know, I'm using air quotes, quote unquote, static information there. You think differently about the. What are your thoughts on the relevance of dashboard in a world of GPT?
I have thoughts. So, first of all, there's no doubt there's disruption coming, right? And the things that we can do, you know, I'm sure almost everybody listening and watching has played with GPTs and has probably mostly gone beyond doing goofy things like writing poems to actually doing productive things that are transformational. I've spent a lot of time this year using the GPT interfaces to try to in search of the answer to the question, can I do exploratory data analysis using these tools, right? So ChatGPT 3 and 4 are laughably bad at data analysis, but that's because they're large language models. They're not trained to be analytical models, reasonable. ChatGPT-4, they released the code interpreter plugin that was renamed Advanced Data Analysis, and now it's just embedded in ChatGPT-4. That professes to be able to do exploratory data analysis. And it kind of can. I've done a few experiments where I upload a data set I don't know, and I try and explore it using GPT in a way I might explore a data set in Tableau. It's like, what? You know, just throw things around. And what I've found is that it's like a well-meaning yet petulant teenager, right? I have two wonderful daughters, 16 and 14. My 16-year-old isn't always very responsive when I ask her to do tasks. So go and tidy your room. And she comes back and it's kind of tidied. I'm like, well, no, let me go. Go and tidy the room and put the things away. Yeah. Okay, you kind of got it right. And it's like this iterative task of asking the same question three times to do a task I could do on my own, but I'm delegating it to her. And that's the experience I have with using GPT to do the work, is that I can ask it to do a task and it will come back with a well-meaning answer, but it's just like, oh, it's not quite good enough. It is amazing what it can achieve, but it's not good enough. And also that ask a question and wait, you know, somebody who has spent nearly 20 years using Tableau, which allows you to just be in the flow with data, you're playing with data, you're moving new data in, asking you questions, continuously looking at different perspectives, you have none of that sense of flow. Ask a question, you wait. Once you've waited 5 seconds, then you go and look at the newspaper, right? And then so you're not concentrating on that task. And the frustration of thinking, okay, how do I reword this question to try and get to a right answer? So I think in current state, GPTs can do a huge amount, They can't replace your analytics tool. So that's one thing. Custom GPTs, ChatGPT announced those a few weeks ago. On the consumer level, I think they are also flawed. So I think the GPTs cannot do exploratory data analysis even to the level of an entry-level analyst at the moment, right? Now, that's going to change quickly as these things iterate, and I'm sure there's going to be some startups on the horizon who are going to come up with amazing applications very soon. So that was the AI side of the question. Then the other part of this is, well, dashboards must be dead, right? You know, there is one of our main competitors' campaign right now. Their strapline across their billboards all across San Francisco and the world says, dashboards are dead. Come and use our AI tool. Now, that vendor, if you actually go and look at their website, they go, da-da-da-da, and save everything on a pinboard. Brackets, pinboards is our name for dashboards. I'm like, all right, so dashboards are dead. Let's all make pinboards. But that actually gets to the point. I hope that in 5-10 years' time, I could just type something in my phone and get an insight, right? That'd be great. But does that mean we're going to stop monitoring information everywhere? Does that mean suddenly people in call centers no longer care about whether the call things are going up or down? Salespeople don't care if they're hitting quarters and don't want to see at a glance whether they're doing things, or people in HR, people in marketing, whatever. It's like, no, of course, they're still going to be monitoring things. So dashboards are not going to die. What we're doing at Tableau, we've got a new feature coming out called Tableau Pulse. And what that does is it surfaces volatile metrics in an organization in a daily email digest or on Slack. The idea of Pulse is that instead of the business users, not the analysts, instead of the business users hunting around loads of dashboards to find whichever KPI might be hot or cold that day, Pulse just services the ones that need attention to them. So if we get that right, that means they will have to view fewer dashboards. And that's great, right? I think that's great. But a Pulse metric will say, well, hey, podcast listens have gone up 200% this month, or they've gone down 200% this month. So you might ask a question why. An insight drives a question. And at some point, you're still going to have to go to the data or a dashboard to get like the answers to the third level question. So for sure, dashboards are going to evolve. Who knows where the GPTs will go? They might become super powerful. They're not there yet. Features like what we're doing in Pulse will maybe lighten the load, but I don't think they're going. Dashboards, in my opinion, aren't going anywhere in the next 5 years. Anybody who watches this in 5 years' time, please email me and tell me, and let's see if I was right or wrong.
Yes, that's a great thing about recording things digitally, is we got a timestamp now of what you said, and can backtrack. But I'm sure we'll be all moved on to bigger and better things by that time. I do like what you said about, you know, having a query and then going and waiting. It reminds me of anybody who was born after 2000 will not know this, but when the internet first came out and you had dial-up internet and you would wait for it, you know, do a search and you would wait for a page to load and you get a quarter of the page, the half of the page, three-fourths of the page. sometimes when I'm talking with these large language models, I feel like I'm having deja vu back to my early 90s days, right? Where, and it was so exciting and we waited for it. And the joke often was like, go make a sandwich, go do something else, right? But it was something we were just used to and we were just so excited about it that now we're back doing it again. But instead of waiting for pages to load, we're waiting for the model to talk back to us.
You can see the potential, right, Sadie? You can see that we're on the cusp of something, absolutely. I mean, it's all right. I mean, the things I have done to be more productive with GPTs, it's been amazing, right? But data analysis, let's just tread carefully and wait a bit.
Yeah, so I think we can all agree, like, it's going to get faster. We don't wait for pages till we don't make sandwiches while internet pages load anymore, thankfully, right? I do believe the analysis side of GPTs and language models get much better. But one of the things that I agree with your point on why dashboards are dead is because dashboards also allow business users to come together to agree on a set of metrics they want to focus on for their business and narrow that focus. And I think if we all are just talking with language models or looking at whatever data we want, we don't have that set focus and that vision that's necessary that having an agreed upon set of metrics allows us to have with the dashboard. So I think of this as like, if we go back to the car dashboard, if we could all pick what we wanted on our dashboard and, you know, maybe one person measures how fast they go and another one doesn't, our driving would look very different, right? But we have a core set of metrics on our car dashboards for a reason, right? Because there's a series of rules that we all need to follow. And I think that's really where the importance of dashboards comes in. It allows us to have a more narrow focus that aligns with those business goals and strategic vision. And I don't see us getting rid of that anytime soon.
No, you're absolutely right. And I to add more to that, you know, I think at a high strategic level, that's absolutely right. And then each team down a hierarchy in an organization will have that centralized thing. One other approach that we try and adopt in Tableau is, this is certainly something the sales organization at Tableau had been in the habit of doing, with the team would have a core version of their dashboard that the sales teams would use for them, for their personal dashboard to help them sell, right? What monitoring who they could call. And what we tried to do is say, well, each team build their dashboard, but then each team member, as they join, makes a copy of that and then evolves that one personally, so that they kind of personalize the dashboard for the way they want to work. And I think that was a really flexible and successful approach within a structure that maintains those centralized, agreed strategic ones. Because the worst implementation of let's build a strategic dashboard is saying, but that's the only version you get, but it is then cutting off access to further exploration, either through your own dashboards or through other access to data. So yeah, it was really nice having that approach in our sales org as well.
So speaking of exploration, one of the things that became, I don't want to say a trend, but also took a lot of talk within the data environment was storytelling with data and dashboard support of storytelling data. How do you see this also evolving in the world of AI, and what is the importance of storytelling with data and particularly dashboards still relevant?
So Amanda, so one of the co-authors of the second book of dashboards, that's not what it's called, but of the second book, and one of our co-hosts on ChartChat, she's been making a great distinction about dashboards actually are for story finding, right? And other vehicles are for storytelling. I really like that as a distinction, because dashboards allow me to, well, if I define a dashboard, which clearly I've said at the start, is a fool's errand. But I think dashboards are generally about guiding somebody through an analytical path. In that analytical path, they can find the insights they need. If I then need to communicate that to somebody, I thought, oh, I found an insight. I should not share that dashboard in a PowerPoint. I should create some sort of other object, entity, asset to tell the story. So for me, there's a distinction we should make. or could start making, dashboards for story finding, something else for storytelling. Trends, you know, when we talk about AI, right? So let's say that AI does kill the dashboard. I don't think it's going to happen. But let's say Tableau Pulse is so successful that somehow we could surface all the insights to our users. So they only ever need to see the Pulse Digest because it will tell them what's hot in the business. At that point, that's where I think story... Okay, here we go. I'm going to make the claim. I think storytelling will survive longer than dashboarding in analytics. Right, there you go. Okay, somebody can hold me to that in 10 years' time because I've not made that conclusion before. But I think because perhaps there are ways AI can monitor things, but humans still need insights, still need to share insights. And I think we still need humans to bring each other along to drive change and progress in our business or our organization, whatever we're trying to do. So, yeah. So I'm not sure I answered your question there, Sadie, but I feel like I came to a prediction.
No, but I like where we're headed with this. Yeah, I like where we're headed with this prediction because I do agree that storytelling will survive all the test time. Whatever new technology we come out with, it will just be here to assist. But if you look at our history and role as humans in a civilization, the only thing that's kept us alive has been our ability to share stories, right? I had an amazing opportunity to go and see hieroglyphs in Kenya this year and then in Hawaii and all these different places. And you realize, like, we as a human species have needed stories to survive, right? They played a vital role in terms of telling us where water was or where food was or where danger was. And those stories now have evolved over time. And so, you know, we have amazing new technology to what we had 2,000 years ago, and yet we're still telling stories. So we're going to time stamp this one too, because I've doubled down in and saying, I think storytelling until I die will stand the test of time.
Storytelling until you die. Yeah. Well, it's right. And it's not just story, right? It's about what are we trying to drive in business, in organization? We're trying to drive forward progress. And to do that, it might mean I have to convince you to change your mind or to follow me, to follow my strategic direction, right? And in order to do that, I could just email you a chart. Well, that's not going to do anything, is it? It's the emotion. It's like, Sadie, look at what this chart shows. This chart shows that we are, if we do this, this projections are going to hit. And, you know, I've looked at the data this way and that way. And it's these things. It's like, AI is not going to do that.
No, I have to admit, so from my piano performance background, when I was an analyst, I added a little bit of theatrics into my display of dashboards, you know, and what always brought the most people in was when you added a little bit of a suspense, right? I loved outliers and data because I'd throw them out there and, you know, have people guess, like, what is this reason? How could this be happening? Why do I see this pattern? And it's that kind of storytelling that sucks people in and gets them involved and gets them invested. And I'll be honest, I had a little too much fun with that when I was an analyst.
It's amazing. I'm a magician, right? In enjoying understanding the psychology and neuroscience of data visualization, it led me to realize that, excuse me, those same processes are what magicians use, but in data viz, we are trying to use the eye and the brain to make sense of things, but magicians use those same processes to confuse and entertain. But the skill of a magician, again, like a pianist, the power of a magician is how they use their voice and body language to control an audience, right? And it's been amazing learning that skill. And I realized just the other day, I was like, actually, when I present data stories, there are things I do that I know as a magician will work that I put into my presentations too. So, and I was like, and sometimes it's a little deceptive. I'm like, don't tell anyone I said that, Sadie. Keep a secret between me, you, and everyone else.
We will. We're just sharing this, you know, over the internet. So the secret's safe with me and the World Wide Web. I'm curious, what came first, data visualizations and storytelling, or being a music a magician? Was there one that came before the other?
Oh, no, it was data visualization. And then Stephen Few actually gave me a book in about 2011 called Sleights of Mind, which is about the neuroscience of magic. And it just blew me away. It was like, oh, my God, I love this field of data visualization. I love the fact that, you know, using the eye to focus on pre-attentive attributes and focus language annotations. But I can use those same things to misdirect and put false memories in people and confuse them. And so data viz came first. And then that book just lit a spark that I think had been there, you know, since a teenager, but being a teenager or a young boy. And yeah, it's been great fun.
I love that you had a moment when you read a book and it changed like a trajectory of your life, right? I also had a moment that I was studying piano performance and someone gave me the book Musicophilia. And it was about how the brain interprets music. And that made me change my degree from music to neuroscience. And so it's just amazing how you can, one, don't underestimate giving someone a book, right? Because we both were given these books and ended up getting new habits and new industries that we're excited about. So I think a book is a gift that keeps on giving for sure. So be sure to give everybody.
I just read Your Brain on Music by Daniel Levitin, I think it was. That was a book about neuro. Yeah, amazing. A lot of people listening to this will be thinking how they can progress their own career. You know, what have we talked about here? We talked about piano, music, magic, performance. To be a successful data analyst requires a really diverse set of skills. You don't have to be, well, knowing technology, knowing data, and knowing how to use software is obviously a core part of the skill. And the skill, but the creative arts are as important a source of input into a data analyst's daily work as any of the sciencey things. So, you know, go do music, go draw pictures, go look at mountains, go and do humanities, arty things. It'll be a great improvement for your skills.
Do you think that the humanities, I'll just follow that subject to the one here, will be more important as we have advanced in technology? So we seem to be automating some of the hard skills. Do you think that we're going to see a shift back to the humanities and that's what's going to make you a rock star analyst?
For years, it's been really easy for me to say, look, humanities skills are vital, right? I push anyone who says hard and soft skills, I'm like, there's no such thing. They're all vital skills. Alberto Cairo was the first person who, he said it in a tweet in about 2018, says, don't talk about hard and soft skills. So, I haven't thought about that. Will AI mean, certainly there's a great example in a book called A Fuzzy and the Techies, which is somewhere down there, which is about the need for humanities skills in technology. And they were in that book, there was an anecdote about driverless cars. I mean, the book's about 6 years old. But they were saying the technologists were pretty good at making cars kind of drive on their own. But the sticking block there was that the cars couldn't interpret humans and the humans couldn't work out what the cars were doing. And it's because they didn't have any humanities people who could bridge this gap of the technology interface to the human interface. And so that gap between tech and humans was where humanities skills are absolutely vital, because you get that critical thinking, the power of empathy, the power of research, the power of, you know, just thinking, looking around and thinking about how people interact with the world, right? That's humanities skills. So, I'm just going to have to go and ponder the answer to whether AI will elevate the humanities need or not. Yeah, great question. Right. Oh, it's all predictions. This is like, in how many years? Go on, put a time on it, Sadie.
Oh, I think it will just continue to accelerate, right? As we see the advancements of AI accelerate. And here's my theory behind it, is because we'll be looking for what it means to be human. And so I think the humanities is what it means to be human, right? To create, to express yourself through art and music and poetry and language and philosophy. And so I think we're going to go back to what it means to be human. And I think the humanities are the best way to do that. That's my prediction. So anyway, we'd love to get some advice from you in terms of just career. You had a robust career. You seem excited and loving what you do every day. And to me, like, that is the ultimate career success, right? It's one where, like, you wake up and you're excited to create and to talk to people and, you know, take on that next project. How have you found a career that you love?
So, I turned 50 a couple of years ago. I'm nearly 52. And it was quite strange. I hit 50 and suddenly my brain went, what's the point? What are you trying to achieve? What have you achieved? What are you going to do with the rest of it? And you know, it was quite a rocky period for about 6 months as I was like going through all this self-reflection. You know, out of the other side of that, I mean, holy cow, do I recognize the privilege I have to have the job I have. I get paid to inspire people to think differently about data. And I'm somebody who is an expert in the field, who is an extrovert, who likes talking and generates ideas. So I am very fortunate that I have the support from Tableau to do this job, and I've got it, right? How did I get this job? Well, I feel like I had a millennial portfolio career before they were invented. I have been very fortunate in my career to have so many different jobs without having to give much thought when I'm changing careers about which direction I'm going. And, you know, I'll very briefly go through that. But before I do, I recognize my privilege. I had a very good education, very supportive parents, and I'm a white guy, right? So my experience is my experience. And I can't profess that it should be everybody else's, or it could be everybody else's. But I left school wanting to go and do the art. I left school with a place on an art college degree. I wanted to go and draw comics. I spent the summer in the Arctic looking at glaciers. So I decided I wanted to do geography instead. So I went to do geography at Edinburgh. After that, I then discovered the internet in 1994, very early internet. So that turned me into, I went and did a master's in computer science. My first job was software engineering, writing school programs for elementary schools. Then went to a database job in 2003, got made redundant. So I took my bike to New Zealand for a year where I just cycled around, worked in a hotel as a guide, did journalism. Then did some business research for a company back in the UK, where I started looking at their databases and building one page sheets of charts for my boss. I didn't know they were called dashboards, but I was just trying to give him as much information on one page as I could. And then I got a job at the University of Oxford as a data analyst. Downloaded Tableau in 2007. Here I am, 13 years later. Right, so there you go. That's Andy's career history. Why have I given you that? Because we talked about it in the previous question. I was an artist, a geographer, a journalist, a business researcher, a project manager, a data analyst, and you know, a few other things. So what advice do I have people wanting to get a career in data or even try and be an evangelist is you need a wide set of skills, right? You know, there are many things you need to be to succeed in data analysis. You don't need deep skills in any of those. And you don't need to do what I did, which was kind of focus on each one of those at separate times of my career. But, you know, try and pick up those skills. So how did I get the job? I was just very lucky to, every time I got bored or there was a roadblock, I managed to find another great opportunity that worked for me. I realized that, you know, the job market is not the same as it was 20 years ago. It's like maybe harder to do that. But I amassed a diverse set of skills and I took every opportunity. You know, I also took every opportunity to develop skills I needed for this job. I mean, particularly speaking, public speaking is one example. You know, on top of everything that I do, I've had so much speaker training, and it's because I've sought it out and always said yes to every single opportunity. One can never stop learning. So there you go. That's Andy's career in however long that took me, 2 minutes.
No, I think it's great to share. You know, a lot of times when people share their career journey, they share me past 2-3 jobs. And I think it's so important to share. Now, this is where it started, right? There's other, you know, starting from the bottom, right? Now we're here, okay? Because I think it's so helpful for others to know who may be going through their own career change or not sure what the direction is. And I think it's just helpful to see that there are no mistakes in this winding path of art and geography and, you know, all the different roles that you've been in. It all comes together and helps you now today in ways that you may be conscious of or ways you may not be conscious of, right? And so,
That's I had to do some career advice talks recently, and I was like, oh my god, I'm gonna have to go back to when I was 17 to tell this story, because it really is part of the whole story. You know, I am I an artist in my job? I mean, yeah, I am. I get to make creative stories with data, right? And the art stuff I learned then and have been learning through my life is important. And I was like, yeah, so whatever job people are doing now, you know, it all feeds in this mushy pot of experience.
If someone's going through one of those transitions, is there a North Star that you always had within each of those stages? So whether, you know, now as you look back, you can connect all the dots, but what was connecting the dots for you while you were on that journey?
The short answer is no, I never had a North Star, right? Now, when I got my first graduate job, we did some graduate training. And in that graduate training, the trainer said, okay, you're all young graduates, take a moment to relax and then go on these big whiteboards and imagine where you'll be in 25 years and draw that. And I drew mountains and cloud and a lake and some sunshine. Everybody else in the room drew cars and houses and money bags. I mean, I kid you not, right? And I was like, ugh, am I weird? And then I remember the guy saying, only, you know, you will only succeed if you write down a career plan. That's the only path to success. I was like, God, that sounds like the worst possible idea ever. So I literally didn't have an North Star. Now, and that I'm very lucky that worked out fine until this moment when I was 50 and I was like, well, where do I go next? And so I have a much more specific career goal now. But it's largely to do what I do better, right? You know, I found where I needed to go, but I didn't know I was getting here. And you always see the business gurus who are like, you must have a plan. This is how to make your strategy. And sometimes I feel like a charlatan for going, well, I ended up with a great job, but I had no idea how I got here. So follow that advice, kids. Like, oh, is that right? I don't know. But that's the truth.
I love it. There's room, you know, just as there's room for different schools of thought and what a dashboard should or shouldn't look like. I think there's room for different schools of thought and life design and career design paths. So, you know, sometimes just following your bliss works out and it all comes together. And
it's okay. I know it, you know, cost of living is really hard, high these days. It's harder, but hopefully it can still work for lots of people.
Well, as we wrap up today, any last piece of advice or thoughts that you want to share with our audience?
No, just check out the links. If you've got great dashboards, we want to see them because we would love to feature world-class dashboards in the second book. I guess the other thing is subscribe to my Sweet Spot newsletter where I share, I curate things about the data zeitgeist and share my thoughts about them once a month on LinkedIn and the newsletter. So follow those. But otherwise, get out there, explore your data, steal like an artist, go and draw a picture, play a piano, and learn some technology at the same time. It's all wonderful.
I love it. What a great way to wrap up. Thank you, Andy. This has been a fantastic episode. And a big thank you to our listeners. Remember to stay curious and keep learning. And we'll catch you next time on the Data Bites podcast. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Data Bites podcast. If you're looking for more resources to further your data career or find your tribe, we encourage you to become a member at womenindata.org. See you on the other side.